Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 399th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Scott Fitzloff. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Luke Corum and Pat Barry on the show. They've got a new movie out on Paramount Plus about the Milli Vanilli scandal, aptly titled Milli Vanilli.
Yeah, it is good.
We've had Luke on. This is his third time. I'm trying to think of other filmmakers we've had on as regularly as Luke. Carlin obviously comes to mind, but
Roxy. We've had a lot of people on multiple times, but I think Jim Cummings, maybe.
But it's great to have Luke back. We had him early on. I saw a screening of his film Delt at a film festival. It was an incredible screening. It was so fun. I said, Oren, we got to get these guys on the show. And then I think they pitched us kind of simultaneously. And I was like, oh, I was at this screening. Let's meet up. We've been pals ever since. They came back. They did a show called Action on Showtime. Luke is back to talk with Patrick, his editor, about Milli Vanilli.
You know what my favorite thing about Luke Corum is? Whether it's true or not, he seems to me like a real fan of the podcast.
Also, he has a very good knack for distilling what's interesting about a subject into a concise handful of sentences. Like in talking with him, I was like, oh, I would buy this movie from you. This is great. He synthesized what's interesting and human about this story. And we talk about it a little bit. I think this movie is about, you think you know what it's about because we've all heard the headline before, but Luke has a knack for not only telling the human side of the story and revealing additional parts, untold parts of the story, but also in talking to us, I realized, oh, he's very good at explaining why this film is going to be good and why it's going to be exciting and captivating, which I think is a lesson that other filmmakers can carry forward, because essentially what we're talking about is just pitching in a really organic way.
Yeah, I think that is the skill that filmmakers get that's very important to have a successful career. And people don't talk about it that much, but it's pitching your ideas, you know?
When you hear pitch, you think like, okay, I've got a deck. And, you know, you're like, picture this, scene one, this happens. And like, maybe that works for some people, but it tends to work a little better when it's more organic and more natural and more conversational, basically, but still as exciting as you want it to be.
And people get, the longer you pitch things, like I'm sure your movie that you're working on, I'm sure you're better at pitching the core concept now than when you were writing it.
Yeah, 100%. It kind of synthesizes as you go. You kind of get the core of what's interesting about it.
Right, and you see what people are reacting to. So it's always easiest to pitch something after you've made it. But yeah, it's a really fun chat. I've been doing a lot of screenwriting recently and listening to podcasts to try to like get inspired about screenwriting and just talking about setting up characters and stuff. So maybe we'll do an episode on that. Hit us up, you know, send us a message, justshootapod@gmail.com, or just DM us on Instagram or something at justshootapod and let us know if that's something interesting. And you know what? Feel free to pitch us some topics. We especially love it if there's no guest attached, because we get a lot of pitches of like, oh, you should have so-and-so on. They will talk about this thing. And then we have them on and they don't say anything about that thing. So we love hearing topics that you're interested in. Let us know. And the other thing we love to hear, that cha-ching sound every time we get an email from Patreon telling us we have a new patron, because it just means that this podcast is still alive, still chugging along after 8 years. You can check out our Patreon. It's patreon.com/justshootitpod. Really is a place solely. I know we say this every week, but it really is just a place where you are saying, hey, I enjoy this. Matt and Oren are helpful in some way or hurtful in a way that I appreciate. And here's $1. Here's $2, $4, $20. Any level of dollars you want to give us makes us realize that we should keep going. Patreon.com/justshootitpod. Check it out.
Let's hop into our conversation with Pat and Luke.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, we're back with Luke Corum, third time guest on the podcast.
Hey, well done. Well done.
You know, we just had Ira Rosenzweig on the podcast, and he's like, it was the second time, and he's like, am I allowed to come back? Like, do you ever have guests back again?
I'm always like, coming back. I'm bummed I missed the 400th episode.
So close.
I was trying
so
to close. Time it just right.
No, so. Three. Have you ever been to a store and seen 400 written on a shelf? No, you know what they write?
$3.99,
baby.
That's why we saved this for you, because you're an everyman.
Thank you.
And when people into Pavilions or Vons and Gelson's or Whole Foods, nothing below those. They will think of you. Oh, yeah. Oh, we also have Patrick on.
I call him Pat, editor extraordinaire.
Oh, there we go.
Have you guys worked together before?
Yeah. So I met Pat doing Action, the series for Showtime, which was the last time I was on here. But no, Pat ended up being the lead. We had six editors on that thing. It was an intense series and turnaround. And he ended up being the lead. And then we hit it off. And I was like, you know, when this thing with Milli Vanilli came along, I hit him up and he had never edited a feature, but I was like, I know you can do it. Like this, you can totally do it.
And he edited like hours of TV.
Pat, you tell him. You've done everything, dude. He's done a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've done a lot. And I started in like the unscripted world, and I've been working in documentary a lot for the past several years. Yeah. So I met Luke on Action. I think we really developed a good working relationship. And it was during COVID when they hit me up with this new idea that was about Milli Vanilli, which is not a band that I had heard of before.
Yeah.
But Pat, you tell them about your humble Pat beginnings of Deck Dynasty. 16? Man.
Yeah. I started on Duck Dynasty way, way back in the day. Oh, nice. I was like one of my first editing jobs.
And we have a Duck Dynasty editor on.
Would you know Jody? Jody McVeigh Schultz?
Of course I know Jody. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was actually out to Jody to work on Action. And then that's what led me to Pat.
That's so funny.
Jody was like, dude, like Pat's great. And boom.
He was one of the people that taught me to edit.
Learning that the documentary world is small is always inspiring to me, because it seems like kind of the best sector of filmmaking to be in right now in particular. But I'm curious about how this movie came to be. Milli Vanilli is kind of a story that, you know, we're all of a certain age, give or take. So like, we're not super, I wasn't super aware of the fine details of this story. I remember them being superstars, and I remember the scandal, and that was kind of it. And they were also, I think maybe a cartoon version of them was on the Super Mario Brothers Super Show. And I think I've just explained everything I remember about Milli Vanilli.
Yeah, there you go.
And but they were famous. The scandal was famous that they turned out they were lip syncing the whole
time. Wait, how old are we all here? How old is everyone
here? I turned 41 2 days ago.
I'm between 30 and 50.
I didn't know much about Milli Vanilli other than the guys that lip synced. It's this huge scandal. But there was this one episode on VH1, they're famous Behind the Music series. And this was the pilot, which turned out to be aired hundreds of times and was the most famous episode. And so what happened was I was brainstorming ideas with my producing partner on this doc, Bradley Jackson, who we've worked for 10 years together. Basically what happened was I've known that they're lip sync guys and that they're talentless frauds. That's what people know them for. But I came across this YouTube video where Fab is telling his story at the Moth in New York City. And at the end, he sings and he has this beautiful voice.
Oh,
I thought, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Why would you ever agree to lip sync? And it led me down this rabbit hole of discovering that there was a producer who had pulled off this con before with another band in Europe, and that these guys didn't create the con, someone else did. And then I was like, well, wait a minute. Like, I just went to one level to the next. And I was like, well, what happened to the real singers? Why did they do this? And then, what it boiled down to was like, there's a lot of stories out there where people know the headlines, but they don't know the human story behind it. And I was like, let's throw out the sensational headlines and let's talk about the humanity behind it. And then the second part is, let's talk about the pop machine that sold this scam that no one wants to talk about, which happens to be Clive Davis, the most respected music executive of all time, which is why no one wanted this documentary to be made. So actually, this was like, it took a long time to get this off the ground, because we kept hitting wall after wall, actually.
Wait, so you had no vested interest in Milli Vanilli aside from seeing this episode you liked on of VH1?
Correct. Yeah, I was too young to, you know, I was 8 years old when the scandal happened. So,
I mean, at this point, you've made this incredible feature indie documentary, Delt, which I still love and tell people about, like, to this very day.
Thanks.
About this blind magician who, like, wins the close up magic awards and is so good. It's so into shuffling cards. He's literally shuffling cards while making love with his wife. And then you made a show for Showtime, but now you're kind of like in the machine and you're kind of you've made it in Hollywood. You have deals with TV networks.
You're established, like, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How is it that this thread is like what you choose to pull on, or do you have like 20 different things that you're kind of are up in the air and you're trying to see which one is going to hit?
I found that when you make the greatest thing, most of the times it comes from your idea, especially early on in your career. You know, people bring you stuff and they bring you ideas and you get pitched things, but a lot of times they want you to just be a director for hire, which is not a bad thing. But it's hard to find a project where you really fit not only the story, but also the company making it. And those two things have to be aligned to make something great. If they're not aligned, you might make something good, or it might just be okay and no one ever sees it. And for me, I've always been about, like, how do I make something great? And how do I make it better than the last one? How do I always elevate it? And
when you say better than the last one, are you talking about better than the last time this topic was covered, or better than your last project?
Better than, like, my last project. So, like, how do I stretch myself creatively? How do I, like, for instance, Pat being in this podcast, a big part of this is like, I edited with this other editor, but he did a year and I did a year. It was a long process. The feature doc Delt. I didn't, I knew I could edit, but like I wanted to just direct. I wanted to focus on that. And so I wanted to do a project. We had more resources, et cetera, but where I could find someone who was better than me at editing and that person could be the editor. I can just direct. That's how I met Pat, you know? And
when so on this, action, you, oh, well, oh, right. On action, Pat.
Yeah. On. Yeah. We met on action and it was fun. It was effortless. You know, like he would do stuff and we'd just be excited about it. You know, it's just like why you get into movies in the first place. You're just like, you know, we were the last ones at the office. It was with Boardwalk Pictures, which is a really big, you know, production company. And we'd be shutting it down to like midnight. It didn't matter because we were having fun. And when we left that project, I remember like we were talking in the parking lot, like, man, we're going to work together again. You know, like this was too much fun.
That makes sense on a personal level for sure. I'm curious, you, circling back a little bit, you'd mentioned the idea or the aspect of being a good match for the company. Elaborate on that a little bit more, because I think that's not a thing that we talk about quite so much.
Yeah. Feel free to tell us what makes the bad match, you know.
I can definitely tell you that. Okay. If you're talking about documentary specifically, I can really break it down really quickly on that. There are some companies that slap things together, that it's not about making it great. It's just about let's get to the end.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. And that will drive someone like myself nuts. Because
Patrick,
that means,
have you worked on stuff like that?
Yeah, I've worked on those certainly more than a handful of times. Like, you know, it's always kind of the luck of the draw, certainly. And I think you can probably have a decent idea going into it. Like, you know, you don't, at least I don't take every job for the same reason. And so some of them you might sort of know what you're going into. But, you know, it's a job. It will keep you employed for a while. And then other ones, you know, are more about what I'm really passionate in. And so certainly I've been there, and I'll leave it at that for now, at least.
What are the red flags, maybe? Like, how would you, one, recognize, oh, maybe their standards aren't in line with my own?
Well, one, you got to look up what they do in the past, because there's got to be a pattern. Very rarely you're going to find a company that like that pattern changes and there's an anomaly, you know, like it's not, don't go into something hoping that it'll be something else than what's been, they've done in the past. So if that quality isn't there or what you want to make is there, don't go into it. Unless it's a paycheck, then you got to do it. Like I've been there too. Like you just got to take that, but make sure your expectations are aligned. I think that's something to really talk through in those pre-interviews with these executives is like, you know, timelines and like size of your crew and like, you know, what's your support going to be like? And, oh, how many edit weeks am I going to have? You know, that's a huge one. That'll tell you right there what kind of show you're making.
Can you tell us on like Milli Vanilli, how many weeks you guys had to?
Yeah. So Milli Vanilli was a project where it was my production company and MRC is a finance company. They financed it. So I pitched it to them and they financed it. And MRC does things like, this was like one of their, this is like their second documentary. They've done most things in scripted. So they did House of Cards, Ozark, The Outsider, then movies like Baby Driver, like that. And my manager,
it's like
hooked
big
me
budget
up,
stuff.
Big budget stuff. But my manager hooked me up with them and they just got into nonfiction. And I was like, I pitched the executive and he was like, great. Like literally, it was like, on a Zoom, it was like, he was like, I'll hit you back next week. And I was like, well, I'm pretty positive we just got that sold. And we did. We put a budget together. So I had control.
Does he, when you pitch him, do you have any idea what the budget range that they're even looking at is? Because I imagine
no.
There's probably, for a doc feature, the budget can be probably anywhere from $200,000 to like $5 million. Like I imagine it's a pretty big range.
No, that then got hashed out, you know, after that. I think I'm soft. Played a number to him on the pitch, like what I was thinking, and it went up from there. But that's where we kind of like making sure we're on the same like wavelength. And then what I like to do with a documentary, if I control it, if it's is normal, and I will say this is pretty standard. If you're making like a, as they call it, premium, I don't like that word, but like if you're making like a cinematic documentary feature, normally networks give you 18 months right now. Maybe, you know, 20, 22, but like that's the ballpark.
Is that different than like a Making a Murder or an action or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Series is different. Series is completely different animal. And also you have multiple editors layered on top of each other, and Pat can speak to that. I mean, action, we did it in 6 months, but that was not normal. Normally it can be like about 10 months to 12 months, you know, and multiple editors.
So faster than a feature.
Yeah, they're always faster. Series typically feature.
Interesting. Even though it's way more hours of finished content.
Correct. Yeah. It's more of a machine, multiple episodes at once. So you're not making 6 hours. You're making them all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You're making six features at once rather than one feature at once, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So this one, I think Pat worked on it for a year. Is that right, Pat?
I think a little 14 over. Months. I think about 14 to 15 months is about right. Certainly not like full time by the end. It was, you know, kind of spot work here and there, but I would say like a solid 13 or 14 months.
Yeah. I remember talking to you about this when you were on for Action, Luke. It's just, as a scripted guy, it's so mind-boggling to hear like, oh, you're in edit for a year on something is so monumental. So walk us through that a little bit, Patrick. Like,
yeah. And I have a question just before you walk us through. Like, my assumption is that in a documentary feature, there's always a moment where it's bad, where the movie is not good mm-hmm. in the middle. And I think kind of what you were saying about companies is maybe some companies will be like, okay, it's good enough. Let's try to finish it by next month. And the companies that want to make it good are like, we know there's a good movie mm-hmm, here. Mm-hmm. Let's keep pushing through, you know?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. You know, I can say, so Luke mentioned this was the first documentary that I've cut, like the first feature film that I've cut. And we were given like we were very lucky to have like such a long, like, you know, we didn't have somebody breathing down our neck to like, you know, we need to see a cut. We need to give our thoughts on it. Like, you know, what have you been up to? We were really left to like do this on our own, which has not been my experience with, you know, all of these other things we talked about, these series where you have like the more, mm-hmm. I don't want to say like a factory style approach, but the more like, you know, you're working as a team, you're putting things together. It can be, you know, very creative in a different sense, in a more pressure filled sense, you know, sort of with these extra, like the extra time that we had, it allowed us to like really explore this, but then you sort of can run into these dead ends a little bit. And I recall, like, you know, we really hit the ground running. We cut a few of these early scenes that we knew were going to be in. We knew like what they were going to be and what the drama was. And as we pushed forward to the center of the film, and, you know, we can see, we know where it's headed. We know that the Grammys are coming, and we know that the downfall is coming. There's all these threads in the film that you're still kind of exploring as you're, you know, basically writing this in real time. And we would just come into these weeks where we would just almost like at the end of the week, just basically throw out what had been done that week. Because we just sort of realized that like, this is not, you know, the way that the Paid in Full beat actually translated into Milli Vanilli's with Frank Farian's, you know, music might be really interesting for us for like, you know, a day or something, but wasn't really fitting into the narrative that we were trying to tell there. And, you know, I think you can speak to this more, Luke. I remember like getting really frustrated and like just having these doubts about like, where are we going? What are we doing with this? And Luke and Bradley were just like, oh yeah, no, this is what happens in the middle. Like mm-hmm. you just sort of get lost in that sort of no man's land for a while. Then you pick it back up and you look back and it sure seems obvious, you know, from that perspective.
I'm curious just on a logistical level, when you're managing these edits, like, how do you structure deadlines and like milestones of any sort, right? Like, or is it much more open-ended, right? Like, if is it truly just like, oh yeah, we know that we're gonna hit a dead end in the middle of the process, or like, you know,
first is how long of a when do we have to complete the film for our financier?
Sure.
So we start there.
Sure.
And then I just back up, and having done it a few times now, I knew, in Bradley, like I knew, like I set, like wrote out the schedules, like this is when we should have an assembly cut, mm-hmm. and then MRC would be like, yeah, we want to see. It was either first or second assembly, like we want to see that. And I was like, all right, and they're like, send me a schedule, and I would just send them a schedule, and they would say, yay or nay if that worked for them. And like, okay, fine, you know. So I think it was like 6 months mm-hmm. was our assembly, and you know, we didn't have a lot of the stuff we were still going to film. We had like, you know, especially when you watch the doc, you'll see there's two sides to the story. And we had like, there was a big hole that we didn't have yet. Mm-hmm. So it was more forecasting what that would be and what these people would say and how the story would go.
Mm-hmm. So the way you pitched it, I don't know if that's how you pitched it to MRC, the way you pitched it to us now, which is Milli Vanilli, actually, they were talented, but there was this producer that basically did this scam with them that was what he was known for. And then huge Hollywood music labels basically made them famous and were complicit in this whole thing. So you know you're going to interview whatever you can of the Milli Vanilli people, them and their families or whatever. You know you're going to interview this producer, anyone related to him that you can get. You had mentioned also who are the actual voices of Milli Vanilli, right? You know, you want to find the actual musicians that are making the music. And then, you know, you want to find some of these producers and like
record
label people that are going to make them big and famous and put them on MTV and get them to the Grammys. Right. So kind of have these four pools of people. How much of the story, like, are you working out before you even talk to them, you know?
Well, I had a deck to put together. We cut a sizzle. Pat cut the sizzle that we used to sell it. It was a bunch of archive. Mm-hmm. And we pulled old interviews that our main subject.
Just from like YouTube?
Yeah.
We used that the moth one as well, the one that you originally had seen.
Sure. Yeah, used that. And Pat put together a great thing and like, and it worked. I mean, but it was also like the sell of like, look, like you got to have faith where it's like, we're going to take like Amanda Knox is something I would reference where it's like, that's a story that people like, oh yeah, I know Amanda Knox. Well, do you, or you just know the headline and you know the sensationalism. Mm-hmm. Throw that out. Like, what if you get Amanda to sit down? So like in this instance, it was like, we're going to have Fab sit down. We're going to have record executives and the people who actually sang the music that were deceived themselves. We're going to have people sit down and tell you how it impacted them. Not the story you already know, but we're also going to find out twists and turns along the way, guaranteed. So it's more about the exploitation of artists in the music world, mm-hmm. which is something that no one has done before. And that's why it sold, is because people in the music world don't want to talk about this. Like, they literally don't want to talk about it, you know? It's like when Weinstein hit, people in the film world, all this stuff came out, right? It's like, in the music world, it's freaking nasty, man. Like, this stuff happens all the time. People are screwed over. And in this case, someone died in Milli Vanilli due to it. You know, and that's why people run for the hills.
Spoiler alert. I haven't gotten to that part yet. Yeah, I remember watching the Taylor Swift documentary. Like, one of the most memorable parts to me of that was, like, we all knew that Taylor won the MTV, like the video awards or something. And then Kanye got on stage and was like, Beyonce was robbed. She should have won this. And it was all like crazy. Okay, that, you know, whatever. This is a crazy thing. And we didn't really think about it that much. But in the Taylor Swift documentary, when she's like, I was a teenager when that happened, sure. You know, like I was winning this thing. Like my whole world was like insane. I was like, not even like my frontal cortex wasn't fully formed. And this megastar Kanye jumps up, takes the mic out of my hand and tells me that I shouldn't have won the Grammy in front of the entire world. Like, imagine how that made me feel. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it's like exactly what you're saying. Like, just hearing her point of view on this is just changes the entire way you like look at this whole story.
It makes the story fresh. It makes it new again.
Yeah. And so human too, you know?
Which is what people resonate with, you know?
You started telling us you were running into, like bumping into some issues with like the music industry, that they didn't want to make this movie. Was that before you brought it to MRC or after?
The whole time, even when we went to sell it, I mean, the whole way through. I mean,
so why do you decide to push on this when you never really answered the question, but I'm assuming you had probably a lot of projects you were kind of figuring out which one you're going to dive into next.
Yeah. And I took some stuff, you know, just to pay the bills and stuff along the way. And, you know, nothing like to put on the resume, you know, that I was.
Can you tell us, you don't have to be specific, but what kind of jobs does a documentary filmmaker take to pay the bills between the passion project?
I mean, episodic work, you know, and maybe at the end of the
like
day,
an anthology series or something.
Or of a series, you know, and like they need a director for this episode and one for that episode. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then sometimes you're like, you know what, I don't really want to talk about that episode because it wasn't my show, it was someone else's show, and I'm just basically doing what they tell me to do. And it's like,
it's a docu-series that you're talking about?
Yeah. And it's like not your vision. So you just have to like go along with it. You know, those are really awkward times, to be honest. So that was most of the stuff right there.
Mm-hmm. Did you do any commercial stuff? Like if someone's like, hey, Red Cross wants to make this thing.
I've always wanted to do commercials. You know, it's really funny. Like I know you guys like do a lot of that. And I've always wanted someone to call me up to do a commercial, but haven't had.
I mean, it's a whole genre of commercials. It's like the docu-style.
Yeah, follow doc. Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I guess I don't know. So I've wanted to do that. I've done a lot of consulting. Mm-hmm. I've done that. I've done.
Is that where you watch someone's documentary and tell them how to fix it?
That, but I've also helped people get their docs off the ground.
Mm.
You know, like just help them formulate it from the beginning, developing. So. Mm-hmm. Done that too.
Do you think those doc festivals are like valuable?
Which ones?
Like Holly Docs, or I don't know, all the like kind of, I don't really know the doc world, but do festivals play like a part in kind of helping establish you?
Oh, yes, they do. They do, and then they don't. You know, okay. It's like, it's the same in scripted, man. It's like, if I ask you that question, how would you answer it?
I mean, I think the common knowledge is there's like five festivals that really can blow up your career. And then there's probably another 30 or 40 that can get you meetings, you know, and then anything else is just for fun and motivation. And, you know, going to festivals is
getting into one of those five. It's still not going to guarantee you anything.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
You know, so
no guarantee, but yeah, but you'll be on a bunch of lists. You'll get press, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I would say this, I would challenge it and say this, look at this year's slate of what happened in our industry. Look at Sundance Film Festival, where all the big sales are supposed to happen. I'll tell you what happened in Docs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two films sold. Now, there were two or three that were pre-sold.
Yeah. Well, and also, that's an interesting question. Two films sold at Sundance, but how many?
In the 6 months following.
Boy, that's rough. That's rough.
No, I'll send you the article. No, I know a lot of people that made films.
Yeah.
That have still not sold that film.
That played Sundance.
That played Sundance.
Which is something you always hear in narrative. And I guess, you know, I was teasing a little bit, but like, you know, documentary is a different marketplace, right? Like there's a really high demand for it. And, you know, it's agnostic of stars and things like that. It's really like, oh, is the Milli Vanilli, the headline is the star, right? Like, whereas.
And you might think it's strike proof in a way.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. Boy, it's a bummer to hear that. Even at like the world's biggest marketplaces.
Oh no, the doc market is terrible right now.
Yeah.
It's picked back up in the last 2 months, but I mean, it got absolutely crushed.
Yeah.
And I mean that like, I'm not like overplaying that. That is for real what happened. Like
digging in on that a little bit, is that like streamers are contracting across the board, right?
Right.
Is it just,
they want surefire hits.
Yeah.
They want I mean, this is a different type of topic, but it was like everybody went from jamming with content so that we can attract attention to all of a sudden Wall Street flipped. And it was like, now we got to show profitability, strip everything off of it, pay actors residuals.
Free cash flow, right? Yeah.
Yep. And with docs, it went from, well, instead of giving little money here and here and here to smaller docs, let's go big headline, celebrity stuff. Surefire hits where we don't have to hope that works. Mm-hmm. We know people will watch regardless.
Right. A Jeffrey Dahmer documentary, for instance, it's just like, boom. It's always going to crush.
Yeah. Or what do you think of doing a Milli Vanilli concert film? I mean, concert films are big, right? I haven't seen the ending of the doc yet, so.
Yeah, watch the documentary and then ask me that. Yeah.
In between cutting the movie, you didn't do a festival route, right? Like, how did you land with Paramount Plus? what was that process like? How involved were you in the first place?
That was the pivotal point, you know, like how we're going to sell this thing. And as I said a little bit ago, this was the toughest year in my lifetime for documentaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sales were just wretched and no one saw that coming. What we did, unknowing that that was going to happen, is we had a, let's call it a fine cut, more of like a rough cut, fine cut type of thing. I was inspired by the movie Swingers. Mm-hmm. If anybody's seen the movie Swingers,
sure.
I remember, do you know how they sold that movie? What they did was those guys got rejected by Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
Swingers did. And what they did was they're like, screw that. We're going to screen our film during Sundance when everybody's in what place, and we're going to put our film at a theater right by and get everybody we can there.
The Slam Dance move, basically.
It was pre-Slam Dance, and it worked, right? And it did great. Well, our film wasn't even ready yet. And so, but what I didn't want to have happen is people go to Sundance and spend whatever they got in their wallet, which is what buyers do. And then you kind of get leftovers the rest of the year. That's how budgets work, right? So we decided, we meaning William Morris and MRC, we decided let's host buyer screenings in New York and LA the week before Sundance.
Wait, and William Morris reps you or reps the movie?
They rep me.
Okay.
So we hosted it in LA at the WME screening room. We hosted it in New York at a screening room, had people come out. Some buyers are too good for that, and so you have to actually send them a link because they're like, nah, I'm not coming to your theater. I'm watching my theater, you know, just whatever. Then Sundance happened, and two films sold, which was really bad, and we were like, oh boy.
What are the two films that sold?
Kokomo City.
Okay, I've heard of that.
And the two films that won, and one other film, we basically got buyers interested at Sundance and before Sundance and let the bidding begin. And we thankfully had a film that people were like, in a down year, they were like, we need something that's going to actually work, that we'll get audiences. And it's a good film. I mean, I'm not just understating that, but like, they were like, okay, we can make this work.
I'm curious, Pat, from your point of view, I agree that it's a good film. I really love it, but I, you know, they sing Girl, You Know It's True. And I like know that song, right? From growing up, for someone that isn't familiar with them, like, I almost wonder if that's helpful as an editor to kind of create this human story and this true crime story without having to lock into that nostalgia element. Do you feel like that was part of it? Were you like, was Luke like, oh, we got to keep this part in where Madonna does this like a virgin thing? And you're like, I don't know who Madonna is. So let's edit that out.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting question. I think that, that certainly, like, you know, having not having really any like knowledge at all. When he said Milli Vanilli, I thought, oh, is that like Liza Minnelli or something? Like, I thought it was one person. Yeah. But coming into it, just like having no knowledge of it, you know, I didn't know any of the songs. I didn't have any sort of like pre-written like history in my brain. And so I think you can look, you know, there's disadvantages, certainly, but I think you can look at it more objectively. I think that is, you know, something you can bring to the table.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it is also something in general, just, you know, in editing, like just like this idea that like you're not there when it's being shot, you know, you're not on the set when it's happening, that one of the things that just you bring to the table is I just see the screen, like I don't see what's like outside of the frame, or I don't just know how hard it was for that camera to get set up or how much you were thinking about that shot. It's just like they're all the exact same size on the screen, and you know, it's how you put something together.
I imagine in documentaries an interview might be really hard to get, and people keep brushing you off, and you finally get it and it's not that good, and the director's like, we worked so hard to get this freaking interview, and the editor's like, there's nothing good, like this movie, this interview doesn't make the movie better, like why are we don't have to use it.
Usually you at least have to show it to them.
Right.
Were there ever instances where your naivete or lack of awareness of Milli Vanilli, did anyone ever have to say like, oh, hey, this song was a super hit, you should definitely use it here? Or, you know, was there ever a counterpoint?
How did you even get the rights for the music. Is it all fair use?
Ugh, no. That was probably the hardest part of making the whole thing, because the villain is the guy that owns the publishing rights to the music. And not only that, Sony also co-owns the publishing rights, and that's Clive Davis.
Mm-hmm.
So right. In order to make the film, we actually started making the film and we're a year into it without the music rights.
Wow.
And our financier
and
knew
and
that.
MRC was already attached.
They knew that. Oh, we were making it. Yeah. They were paying for it. But I knew
were
eventually.
You guys making like your bizarro versions of the music?
No, I just always knew eventually they were going to cave. Like they were going to be like, what? Because you know what happened?
Yeah,
you know what happened?
Please. Yeah.
2 weeks ago, Billboard put on the front of their website, Milli Vanilli Doc has the streaming, and I can't remember the percentage, go up X percent. And you know who made that money?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The producer, the record label, yeah. They made tons of money off this film. So that's why they did it.
Wait, sorry. Who made money? Like the people that gave you the music rights?
Yeah.
So they got a licensee fee, but then also people are like, oh yeah, Milli Vanilli, and start listening to it on Spotify or wherever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because your movie gave them a big bump of people interested in the music.
Reignites the
so it's like free audience.
Free press.
Marketing, I guess.
That's why music docs are so hot.
Interesting. Was that part of your pitch to get the music rights?
No, my pitch was, I'm not going to do anything like salacious or gotcha. I'm just going to tell you the story like it is, which we did.
Did it come down to a number, or like what was the tipping point in terms of getting them to sign off on it? Was it just the conversation?
It was a conversation. Lots of conversations.
Yeah.
Lots of conversations.
And was it you on a Zoom?
It was me. I was in Germany meeting with some of his team when we would be filming. I mean, it was.
Did you wear a suit?
No.
You just wore a hoodie? Did you put your hair in dreads or anything?
You're I just wore a hoodie like
in relate.
Yeah. It was freaking wild, that whole thing.
Delt, you literally followed this guy for years and you didn't know what was going to happen. And what happened was incredible. And you didn't know that was going to happen. With Action, you know, you set a super accelerated timeline. So you had a little bit, you know, there's sports seasons and things that you follow and like cycles. So you have kind of a start and end date, but you're really kind of camera crews running around following these different people and seeing how they live their life and what they do and why they do it. And here, you know, I'm only 2/3 of the way through, so the whole third act might be totally different, but this one seems a lot more like kind of beautifully shot interviews and a lot of archival footage and really kind of telling the story, you know, like kind of the facts as they are from kind of new viewpoints that we haven't seen before. But really, it seems from a filmmaking standpoint, you're shooting these like really nice interviews, like a little bit of B-roll establishing.
But it's not verite.
Where these people are nowadays, but you're not spending 3 months following Fab of Milli Vanilli, right?
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that shift? And it like, is it, a, did you like purposely try to make a documentary in a different way? Or is it just like,
Luke, are you like, I need to coach Little League, so we need to have a very clear schedule? Or is that just the movie you sold?
No, it was just the movie. I just respond to what story grabs me. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if it's, I actually get excited if it's something I haven't done before, you know? This one is a lot of archive. I will say near the end, there's more verite and there's a bit of a story I didn't know that actually makes the ending so sweet of this one. But I just love a new challenge. I always love, how do I tell it differently? But also, how do you tell the story that makes that story the best story it can be, you know? And there was actually a little more verite in this film that we had to pull out, because I love verite, but I was like, it just, you know, Pat was bumped and was like, it's not working. And I was like, you know, less is more. And like, you just, you know.
For our less doc experienced listeners, what do you mean by verite when you say that?
Verite, like fly on the wall. Like the person is unaware that the camera is there. You know, it's like this Last Chance You documentary series about football players, you know, and like there's a camera in the locker room, whatever. Just that beautiful, like, I've always loved verite because you feel like you're getting to see this person and in a way that no one else gets to see them, or a real raw reaction. I love that stuff. But I think what Pat did well and our archive producers did well, and archive producers are people that literally just spend time looking at archive footage for your film. And we had an amazing archive producer. is finding the
They search, like they figure out where to find it also.
Yeah, you go like, we just need anything on this type of subject or the day that this event happened, like the day Milli Vanilli was exposed. Right. I mean, every newspaper article, every, you know, news piece. We had this incredible archive producer who did, she was the lead on Pepsi, Where's My Jet, which is a series on Netflix. And she was incredible. And, but what Pat did so well is find the verite in the archive. Because archive can be verite too.
Sure.
And there's this one scene in the film, I'll say, for those who watch it, there's this one scene in the middle, and I think you've already seen it maybe, Oren, or maybe you have, no, you haven't yet, is there's a press conference where...
Is that where they start singing?
And Milli Vanilli, these two guys have to face the press when everybody knows they lip-synced and never sang a single word on their album. And it's the only time in the film where everything stops. And you're in one scene for like 3 minutes. And the way Pat cut it, it feels like real time. And it's everyone's favorite scene because the whole thing is like a roller coaster ride. And then boom, you're just sitting in this. And it's really uncomfortable.
It puts a pit in your stomach. Right. Yeah.
Because the movie is like, it almost feels like it's these things happening to these guys, you know, like that they have very little control. And then it's like all these people put them in this very uncomfortable situation. And then they're like, okay, now you guys explain what happened.
I can't wait to watch. You got to watch that because Pat, when he did it, he just knocked it out of the park. And that's I think there's a way to take archive and make it personal and make it your own, you know, like and I think he did a brilliant job of that.
Thank you.
Well, so my final question, actually, in terms of this gear shift for you, Luke, where we're looking at a different mode of filmmaking, how did you approach the interview process? Right. Because like if Delt being an easy example, yes, there's like sit down and on the fly interviews, but it's much more spontaneous. Do you know what I mean? Right. It's kind of like in the moment based off of the things that just happened. You're asking us to them to recap things or tell us how they feel, things like that. Whereas,
I mean, even Milli Vanilli doesn't, from what I've seen so far, doesn't have a ton of on the fly interviews. It's a lot of, you know, like you did some things which are so smart, and maybe it's like an old doc trick or something, but you basically just had like a bunch of photos of Milli Vanilli and you just handed them to Fab and you said, like, tell me about these photos, you know? And you kind of took him on this journey in time where he kind of opened up about these things, right? And like, you can have a moment where he's just like, not even saying anything, but having an emotional response to a photo. And it's powerful in this way where like the director can just sit back and have a beer.
Hand him a stack of photos, call it a day.
No person do everything.
But are there other things like that? Like how did you prepare for those interviews in particular? Because I imagine you knew you had a finite amount of time too, right?
Yeah. And also like we filmed this a lot in Germany and Amsterdam. So, you know, there's not really any going back.
Sure.
So,
and also you're like high the entire time, I'm sure. Probably difficult.
It was a lot of research, pre-interviews. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people did not want to go on camera. So it took a lot of one-on-one conversations on WhatsApp and Zoom and whatever.
Can you just tell us just like the real idiot's guide to like a pre-interview? What is that?
Pre-interview is getting someone, one, making sure that you want to spend the resources to interview that person.
Mm-hmm.
Because on paper, someone might have a resume that's like, oh, they're going to be a great person to speak to this part of the story. But then you get on a Zoom and something and they're just boring as hell. And you're like, uh-oh.
Oh, yeah, we've had that on the podcast.
Yeah, and you're just like, nope. You know, so that's one. Are they personable? Two, are they going to service your story in a way that someone else might? So we had three record label executives, for instance, one of which was really nervous, but that was good. Right.
Oh, like
his hands even shake.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, he'll be perfect. Right. And, but he was honest, but also kind of like squirrely. So you're like, oh, that'll be great. Another guy was like, looks like he's from The Sopranos. And he's just like, and later when you watch the film more, and he just actually tells you things that no one's told you about Clive and all these other people. Like he just spills the beans. And the other guy was like a political guy, like, oh, nothing to see here. And I was like, well, there you go. You got your three amigos, you know? So everybody was like, are they good enough to spend the money on? Because you're looking at, in a doc, half day minimum for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
Two interviews in a day is normally the most you want to do. Three, unless you're doing super minimal setup, like you're going to kill yourself. So two, so that's a lot of money. You got your crew.
And
so
how big, like, is the crew?
This film, our crew would be about 10 to 12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah. pretty good for like a doc, like crew, you know? So you get your gaffer and, you know, all the stuff, but a little bit more overseas. But anyway, so that was it. And then a lot of research. And then also, how do I, on the pre-interview, walk through some things with that person and write notes of where you strike a chord with them,
mm-hmm.
so that you remember in the interview, oh, go down that, and then reserve things that you want to ask them to have their spontaneous reaction. And that's just a gut thing, knowing like how far to go in a pre-interview. 20 minutes should be enough, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Friendly, right. But don't blow the conversation so that right. when you sit down in front of them for the first time, it's like you're, you know, that I know you a little bit, but I want to talk to you. You know what I mean? And you haven't like wasted it.
Right. Right. Because the goal is to keep things spontaneous. You don't want that to be rehearsed. You don't want them to be like, oh, I know what Luke's trying to get me to say, so I'll just say it or avoid saying it or whatever that may be.
Right. Yeah. And also be honest with them. I mean, that's what I always say is like, if someone's like, hey, what are you going to ask me? I'm going to say, I'm going to ask you tough questions about XYZ. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
yeah.
And you want to do it or not? Like, okay, yeah. And can you show me the questions ahead of time? Maybe I'll send you some topics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And do you send topics?
We should use that, yeah. Oren. I feel like sometimes people will be like, well, can you send us the question in advance? And we're like, well.
Yeah, topics is good. Topics. Unless it's a memory that's very specific that you want them to recall,
mm-hmm.
topics is good. Because otherwise, you're kind of giving, you might even get in their head a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then they'll pre-plan something, which is what you don't want.
It's the opposite. Yeah.
Last question. What's your philosophy? And Pat, I'm interested in your response to of the director or interviewer's voice being in the documentary. Because I think so far I've heard your voice a little bit.
I normally don't like to do that as little as possible and only when appropriate. And in this documentary, it's the most you're ever going to hear my voice, but it's because I put people on the spot at times and the question was important for the mm-hmm. reaction to make mm-hmm. sense.
Yeah.
That's my thought on that. Pat, you go.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much the same. When I'm cutting something together, I will try to avoid it. I wouldn't say at all costs. Like, I'm not going to like bend over backwards to get around it when it makes sense. But if it's in there too much, you start to take away from the actual doc itself and start to put it on the making of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in most cases, you want to avoid that. You know, there are exceptions, but yeah, I avoid it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think most of the time it's included, to your point before, Luke, of like, oh, because people are so surprised, they're not phrasing their response in a way that you could use it wholesale, that you need the context of the question in order for that to understand what they're reacting off of. When Oren asked the question, it did make me think of like, Errol Morris, you hear his voice in this stuff all the time, but kind of to a totally different effect where it's like more of a tonal thing. You're like aware of his personality and how he's joking with the subject or something like that.
Errol Morris does it great, but there's only one
Errol Morris. Yeah.
And then there's Alex Gibney, who kind of is the narrator, right? I think some filmmakers, my personal opinion is, try and do as little of that as possible, because I think also it's lazy in the way that you do the interview. You need to make sure that person builds your question into the answer and know when to like coach them a little bit to do that, or like let them finish and then say, hey, can you do that again? And then your editor can find a way to cleverly do it without your voice. This doc, it made sense only because of the, like, we're putting people on the spot at times.
We had this guest, Ben Berman, on who made also a magic doc about the amazing Jonathan, that it becomes a character in all of his own documentaries. And I think it might be like a comedy doc thing, but there is something pretty fun about mm-hmm. that but it's a different style of documentary filmmaking. It's fun to see you do Delt, you know, kind of these docs where you're kind of waiting for things to happen, you know, versus a doc like this that just feels like much more precise, I guess, like from a filmmaking standpoint. All your stuff is awesome. So thanks for coming back on.
Yeah.
And Patrick, all I know of you is Action, Milli Vanilli, and Duck Dynasty. And I think it's pretty good record.
Not bad.
There's a lot of others in between.
Couple. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming. Oh, I was going to ask Matt, looking at Patrick's Zoom feed, which whatever, we use Zencastr, looking at his video feed, how do you know he's an editor? Our listeners obviously can't see it.
Because he has a couch directly behind him.
Yes, yeah. A couch facing his computer.
Yeah,
behind the computer, yeah.
So people like Luke can sit behind him. Look over his shoulder, not too close, not breathing down your neck, but you can still see a monitor.
Usually it's the dog these days, but Luke spent his fair share of time back
me
there.
Me and Ferris sat on that couch a lot. Yeah,
yeah. I noticed there's no coffee table there because you don't want people too comfortable. Patrick, how do we find out what you're working on next? You got an Instagram account or anything?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram at, I think it's pberry with a 3, PB3RY. And I've got a few things coming down. I will be taking some paternity leave. I'm excited about coming up soon. So
congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Luke, you got anything else for people to keep their eyes peeled for?
Yes, I do, but I can't talk about them. So yeah.
Can you tell us like feature series or episodic or anything like that?
One is a doc feature. One is a scripted thing. It'd be my first foray into scripted. I'll have to.
Very exciting.
And are you come back for episode 500 for that by the time it gets made, you know? And then
are you far enough in your career where you have like the Luke Corum camp and you basically have everyone else do things and you just kind of like give notes?
Oh yeah, it's just the lap of luxury. No, absolutely not. Are you kidding me?
I mean, I do imagine like an Errol Morris or someone or Warner Herzog. Like, I mean, not that they don't do a ton of work, but I imagine they have a big team that does a lot of heavy lifting for them.
And I already said I'm not Errol Morris, so definitely not happening for me.
Do you know how Errol Morris makes his living, Oren?
Commercials.
Chipotle.
Miller Genuine Draft commercials.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying, man. If someone out there wants me to do a commercial, hit me up. I am ready to make some money doing commercials. Let's go.
Luke Corum, professional filmmaker. Do you have a website? Do documentary filmmakers have websites?
I do have a production company called Keep On Running Pictures. So keeponrunningpics.com. That's where you can find me. I'm not on social media. I am on LinkedIn.
Which is social media, Luke. But
professional, man. That's how I'm keeping it these days.
Keep On Running Pics? How do you spell pics?
Like pictures, P-I-C-S.
Well, Oren gets on here. Your website. Do you guys have a few more minutes to hang out and endorse with us?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Unpaid endorsements.
So my unpaid endorsement is the Cuisinart GK Digital Goose Neck Kettle. I was a stovetop Kario classic kettle, like the long neck kettle, Japanese kettle for a long, long time. I love that kettle. I really take my coffee very seriously, and the thermometer broke recently. I was like, okay, I'm just going to upgrade. I'm going to get one of those electric kettles that just boils things immediately. Kind of a curmudgeon about it, and it's really made my coffee significantly better.
It's just so much easier, right?
It's not only that it's easier, but also it keeps your coffee or your water at the exact temperature you need it for as long as you want it, right? So like if you're doing a pour over, before I would get it to temperature and then I would turn the heat off. And so I'd like pour my coffee and then I'd like the water would cool down. And I didn't think that it would make that big of a difference. And surprise, surprise, it does. If you're thinking about embracing a high-tech kettle, this one's $100, which is not nothing, but you can spend like $300 on a kettle. That seems a little silly to me.
Yeah,
so
$100 is like $50 in 2021.
Yeah, yeah. So Cuisinart makes a great gooseneck kettle, and you can make a really killer cup of coffee at home with that and a Chemex, and you're good to go. That is my unpaid endorsement. I love coffee, you guys.
My unpaid endorsement while sifting through my Amazon orders is Shiatsu neck and back massager. This is not a throwaway. This is going to change your life. It is $49 and it is the best neck
massage.
Is
there a brand?
Okay, the brand is Neck Tech, but you spell neck N-E-K.
Oh, okay. Great.
And then tech is T-E-C-K. So
one word? Not
really interesting. Neck Tech store. And I will tell you what, I found this by...
No, I'm pretty sure that it's T-E-C-K, right? Neck yeah. Tech? Okay, yeah. Sorry. I thought you said T-C-K.
Guys, quit interrupting my endorsement. Okay.
No, I found it.
You found it. It's good. Okay, yeah. So what this thing does is it like heats up and it's like this sling and you can pull it down your shoulders and it will really dig in there. It heats up. It has these like ball things. So this AC that works on a lot of the stuff I do, and he's like always lugging stuff around. He's kind of a health nut. My neck, I had this really bad crick and I look like an idiot all day. And he was like, dude, come to my hotel room. I got this perfect thing for you. Give me this Shiatsu neck tech thing. He's like, just turn it on. I swear it's going to work. And he travels with it. And it's awesome. You can put it in your bag, take it with you. Life changer, man.
So this is probably not new to many of your listeners, but it is new to me. I would like to take this moment to give my unpaid endorsement to the original Tonga Hut in North Hollywood, which is a tiki bar that I went to this past weekend. I am a huge fan of tiki drinks. Give me something fruity. Give me something like with coconut and rum. And I went there with my wife this weekend and we went to just have a couple cocktails and I was prepared to be.
This is whelmed. Your wife that you're about to go on paternity leave for. You went to have a couple cocktails.
Go so on. This is why when you live in Santa Monica, you can go have a couple cocktails in North Hollywood because she was gracious enough to give us both a ride home. Because, yes, she is pregnant. And so we had a couple of drinks there and it beat my very high expectations already. So
it slapped. Yeah. Let's just say it slapped.
Tonga Hut co-signed. Though if you have a couple cocktails, you definitely need a designated driver too. And you're like, oh boy. Yeah,
absolutely.
Kaplan, what you got?
I've endorsed this app before. It's called Polycam. I've talked about it a lot. I posted a lot of things like room scans I've done in this app. It uses LiDAR on your phone. You can scan a room, export it to Blender or whatever your 3D package of choice is, plan out your shots. You can also, now I'm remodeling my bathroom. So you can scan your bathroom and figure out, you know. But so they have a new mode. I just paid for it. It's like 50% off from Black Friday or something. I just got an annual subscription. So I was playing with it today. I think they support this thing called Gaussian splatting, which is like the new version of Nerfs, like kind of this 3D scanning thing, which is pretty amazing, but I haven't really played with it much. But they have this new mode. It's called room mode. And you just take your phone, you just point it around your room. What are you shaking your head for, Matt?
You don't listen to my endorsements.
Did you endorse this?
Mm-hmm.
Room mode?
Mm-hmm.
When did you endorse this?
It's a subliminal suggestion.
Yeah. Oren likes to roast me for all of the home improvements that I love to do. And there was a period of time about 6 months ago where I was really heavy into it. And yes, I co-sign room
you
mode.
Is this the room mode specifically?
Yep.
It wasn't just Polycam scanning a room?
Yep. Yep, it was room mode.
Wow. Shocked. Sorry. Well, yes, it's
but
true.
It is great. It is really great.
I did go 8 years ago. I used to like, Matt would endorse a book and I'd go buy it. The Art of Comics or whatever. And then after I did that like three times, I'm like, okay, enough with Matt's endorsements. Me spending money on them. So I'm sorry if I ignore your endorsement on episode 392 of a podcast. But it is pretty awesome. Remote. You point the camera at a wall and it just scans the room really fast instead of doing like all the textures and every shelf and every book and every monitor and every desk. You can have it just do doors, windows, and walls.
Yeah, it does like a white model, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like basically just like what's the bare bones of what your room does. Yeah. So like, oh, there's a bed here, there's a cabinet there, but like it doesn't do the super detailed textured pieces.
Yeah, but it's actually way more valuable, because back in the day I used to scan the whole room, bring it into like a 3D program like Blender, and I would delete everything in the middle of the room because I'm trying to plan out how to shoot in this space. And now it kind of does, it like gives you a clean version of a space and you can 3D scan it. It's amazing.
Can I ask, so say you have this white model,
mm-hmm.
you bring it into Blender.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any wisdom in like taking photos of the different wall textures and things like that, and then mapping that to the different walls? Or is it worthwhile to just use whatever prepackaged textures they have in Blender?
I guess it depends what you're using it for. For remodeling, I don't think you really need. Yeah. If it's your pre-vising shots for something, yeah, I guess you can. You have, even when you just do the room mode now, I don't know if they had it when you endorse it, but you can click this button and it'll put textures, textures
on. I think y'all should have another podcast about unpaid endorsements. Dude, it's actually a pretty good name right there.
Yeah.
Some people tell us that it's like their favorite part of our podcast.
I would listen to you guys banter about that. I definitely would.
Yeah.
And then
well,
like
sometimes
get
they're
mad
really
at
bad.
The other person for when you use their, you know, recommendation and it doesn't go well for you, and then you just keep,
oh, yeah.
I just think,
look
I think
out, Wirecutter, we're coming for you.
I've had so many unendorsements too. Like I bought this thing called the Bug Assault. It's like a salt gun you shoot flies with. Just like, totally doesn't work.
You guys
just makes a mess.
Like 6 years ago, we've been talking about it for so long.
I mean, it's just the biggest disappointment of my life.
It's like a first grader worth of time.
Anyway. If you guys have
unpaid
any questions for us.
Endorsements. That's like a tune y'all should do, like that. Someone should sing it like that. Unpaid endorsements. And then you guys come on and you do it. I'd listen. Keep it short. Keep it sweet.
I don't know if you're joking about our actual tune or if you're pitching a separate podcast.
No, he's pitching a separate podcast.
I'm totally serious about both of these things because I hear it in my head playing so well. Unpaid endorsements like that, and it's like and then you guys come in and you just like talk,
but you know, that's what we do, right?
Yeah, but what
that is what the segment is,
but that he's saying as a standalone episode,
as a stand, and you don't have that song at the beginning.
yes we do.
That's why. Wait, I can't
like
tell
that?
If you're joking.
Yeah.
It's like you think you,
oh my God,
but you have it in your brain from hearing it 1,000 times on our podcast.
I do. Are you serious?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's so in my head. It's because I listen to you guys. Oh, that's really funny.
And it's actually sung by a previous guest, Charles Hood.
This is getting really weird.
If you have any thoughts, questions, you want us to forward stuff to Luke or Pat, email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. You can follow us across all social media at Just Shoot It Pod. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Threads, but I'm quitting Threads. It's turned into an insane anti-my people place. But I'm at O Kaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Thanks, Noah. Produced by Tyler Small. Thanks, Tyler. And you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone.
Unpaid endorsements.
Dun, 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 dun. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.